Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, March 8th. Let the record reflect the time is 3:15 p.m. Today we have present Representative Sadler, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, Representative Fields, Vice Chair Ruffridge, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records, Kelsey Riker with the LIO, and my staff, Clark Bickford. Committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. We have a first bill hearing on two bills, HB 86 and HB 85, both bills coming by request of the governor. My plan is to hear and set aside both bills for further consideration. We have a strict cutoff time of 4:15 today to prepare for budget closeouts. First, we have HB 86, bill by request of the governor, the representatives from the Division of Banking and Securities here to present this bill. Please put your name on the record and begin your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Robert Schmidt. And I'm the director of the Division of Banking and Securities. Thank you for holding this hearing to discuss the Money Transmission Modernization Act. I understand that 50-plus page legislation on the financial industry may not sound exciting, but this bill impacts an industry that most Alaskans carry in their pocket and is used thousands of times an hour by our residents, involving billions of dollars each year. And last year, the unregulated underbelly of this industry resulted in thousands of Alaskans losing tens of millions of dollars. This presentation will have two parts. First, I will discuss what money transmission is. Think PayPal, utilization of cryptocurrency by Alaskans, the Alaska impact of the crypto bankruptcies, and the explosive growth of money transmission in Alaska. Then I'll discuss the Modernization Act and how it will benefit Alaskans. However, answering your questions is much more important to me than getting through my presentation, so should you have any questions, please let me know as they come up. Money transmission dates back to the Middle Ages, when the Knights Templar established a system for persons to deposit gold and silver in Europe and withdraw it in Jerusalem. In America, money transmission took hold with the Western expansion of the country, with entities such as Western Union accepting money on the East Coast, then sending a telegram to an office near the intended recipient, instructing the local office to give the money to the intended recipient. For over 100 years, this was the pattern of money transmission in America. The sender physically going to a money transmitter's office, instructing an amount of money to be sent to the recipient, and the recipient physically going to the local branch of the money transmitter to receive the money. Alaskans can and do still send money by physically going to a money transmitter, but the industry has grown to so much more. The Alaska Uniform Money Services Act of 2008 provides the legal framework for money transmission functions, including currency exchange, transfer or wiring of money, and loading and reloading of payment instruments, including stored value cards. In discussing this legislation, I find it is difficult to reach a balance because a big part of what we're going to talk about is cryptocurrency, but that's certainly not the only thing that is going on in this bill. But cryptocurrency is one of the two main things that has changed the money transmission industry. So we're going to take a little bit of time and talk about cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency is a digital representation of value that is stored on a digital representation of value used as a medium of exchange, unit of account, or store of value. And it's not money.
I have a question. So your definition says it's not money, but I thought that the definition of money was essentially a store of value, medium of exchange, and unit of account. You're saying it has to have at least one of those properties.
The property that cryptocurrency lacks that most people would associate with money is that cryptocurrency is not backed by any government. There is no, when we evolved from a barter economy where you traded goats and wheat and whatever it was with those things to a representation of value, a gold or a silver coin, those were issued by whatever government that you lived under. Today, we've got this green paper stuff that is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. And it's the, it says on every single note that it's legal tender for all debts, public and private. So that being backed by a government, being associated by a government, that's the one aspect of what money is that cryptocurrency lacks. There is no government-backed cryptocurrency. So that's the attribute that it lacks that money has. Have I answered your question?
Sure. Okay.
Cryptocurrency was adopted in the fallout of the 2008 financial crisis, where people around the world wanted a representation of value that was outside of any central bank system and also had a limited supply. So, for example, for Bitcoin, only so many Bitcoin can ever be made. There is an endpoint at which no more Bitcoin can be created. It's built into the design of what Bitcoin is. It does exist outside of any banking system. However, it is both more anonymous and less anonymous than any other medium of exchange. The cryptocurrency ledgers themselves are public. Anybody can look at the cryptocurrency ledgers. However, the key piece is knowing a particular wallet ID, which is this long string of numbers, letters, and symbols. It's unrecognizable gobbledygook to most people, but if you understand or you have somebody's cryptocurrency wallet ID, you can actually go on these ledgers and see where all the cryptocurrency has ever gone. So in some ways, it's outside of the banking system, which removes a great deal of protection, but it also has attributes of being more public, certainly, than cash can be. Going on to the industry in Alaska, we've seen money transmission in Alaska explode. In 2018, we had 111 money transmitters in the state. As of the end of last year, we have 168. So that's a 51% growth. The other thing that's been driving this growth, besides cryptocurrency, and frankly much more important than cryptocurrency, has been the advent of the smartphone. If you have an Apple iPhone, you have Apple Pay in your pocket. That is a money transmission service. If you have an Android device, you've got Google Pay in your pocket, whether or not you use it. And of course, the apps that go along with that are commonplace and are known to many of us: PayPal, Venmo, Cash App, Coinbase, Robinhood, things like that. And that's really what has most driven the growth of money transmission, is the online and mobile payment systems that we've seen proliferate with smartphones. Moving on to the next slide, this really encapsulates the industry as a whole. In 2019, there were 10.5 million money transmission transactions to, from, and within Alaska in a year. In 2022, so 3 years later, it had grown to over 31 million money transmission transactions.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Schmidt. That's right, Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Schmidt. I'm not technically very facile, and so I'm going to ask you to define what a transaction is. Is that when you buy gas with your credit card at the gas station? Is that a cryptocurrency transaction? Please help me understand what money transactions are.
One of the best examples would be a buyer finds a new dresser on Facebook Marketing.
You got to pull that closer to you so you can hear it, sorry.
Thank you for letting me know. If I may, through the chair, a buyer finds a piece of furniture on Facebook Marketplace, for example. You drive across town, you check out the new dresser that you want to buy, and you're going to pay $50 for it. Hey, can I Venmo you the $50 for that dresser? Sure. $50 goes up to Venmo, down to the recipient. That would be one example of money transmission transaction.
So that, through the chair, Mr. Schmidt, that transaction, this does not include if I give you a $50 bill for that dresser.
That would not be money transmission. Handing of a dollar bill would not be a money transmission transaction. And these, through the chair, these numbers are reported to us through the industry, where they report the volume of transactions that are done to, from, and within Alaska.
I'll have so many more questions.
No. This is a lot, and it's a field that has grown just massively in the last few years. So I do appreciate your questions,
Representative Wright.
Thank you, Chair. So is it tracked when you are in another state? If I'm in Alaska and I buy something, use Venmo, in another state, does it track and say, hey, this was in South Carolina or this was in Alaska?
Through the chair, yes.
So would that count? Is it because I'm Alaskan or is it because I was in South Carolina?
That number includes to, from, and within Alaska.
Okay.
Again, through the chair, you find something online that you want to buy. You use PayPal to buy it with. You're buying it from South Carolina. You send money through your PayPal to the South Carolina recipient. That would be a tracked transaction.
Okay.
Representative Kerr.
Thank you. On slide 5, you mentioned that the number of money transmitters is going up. So can you just define a money transmitter? Are we talking about app services as well as banking institutions, or can you just describe what that is?
These, through the chair, these are businesses whose business model requires them to be licensed as a money transmitter. The largest licensed money transmitters, so there's 168 of them. The largest two are doing over $1 billion of business a year. The largest 8 are doing over $100 million of business a year. All of this is to, from, or within Alaska. These are businesses such as PayPal, Coinbase, Robinhood, MetaPay, which is owned by Facebook, Google Pay, which is also owned by Google, Apple Pay, which is owned by Apple. These are businesses that send and receive money outside of the banking system.
Just a follow-up.
Through
the chair, are there other kind of defined money transmitters that aren't these sort of app-based or cryptocurrencies, or is this kind of a limited term?
The main exceptions, if you're using it, the exceptions would be, first of all, a payment system. And to use, for example, the company Block. Most of you are probably familiar with Block through its Square payment device, where you can use a credit card or your debit card to pay for something. That is not a money transmission transaction. Block also owns Cash App. If you use money that you have on Cash App to pay for something, that is a money transmission transaction. The other noteworthy example is Zelle. Zelle is owned by a consortium of 7 banks, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Bank of America. It is a bank-to-bank transfer within their system, and they rely on their banking charter to transmit those funds, and it is not regulated as money transmission. It's a banking function. So Zelle often gets grouped in with the money transmitters, but they, in fact, are outside of the money transmission. Another thing that's money transmission, stored value cards is the fancy word for them. Gift cards that you see in grocery stores where you can buy an Applebee's or a Google Pay stored value card. Those are also covered by money transmission. And through the chair, have I answered your question, Representative Garrick?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Virtual currency is another name for cryptocurrency. I want to talk about the explosive growth of this in Alaska. This is the number of transactions. It's not the dollar value. So whether it's $1 or $100,000, we've gone from 84,719 cryptocurrency transactions in 2019 to a high of 3.2 million in 2021, which has now receded quite a bit to 1.9 million. But of course, that's way above where we were.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Schmidt, again, I'm not sure. I don't know much from Bitcoin, so give me an example of what a virtual currency transaction, a Bitcoin transaction within Alaska. Is it the same, you know, purchase of a couch or a dresser or something else?
Through the chair, yes. The same example of if you want to buy a couch or a dresser or what have you off of Facebook Marketplace, or Craigslist, and the buyer and the seller both agree to a price in Bitcoin, you could do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I should also point out, it is easy to cast dispersions on cryptocurrency when you live in the country that has the world's strongest currency, the dollar, the U.S. dollar. But there are certainly people that are from or have family that live in countries that have a much less resilient currency, and for whom sending Bitcoin or sending Ethereum might be preferable to sending the local nation-state currency. Representative Sidar, have I answered your question?
Yes, yes, sir. Yes, okay. Thank you.
It is also the division's observation that cryptocurrency currently operates in two spaces. The first space is as a security, as an investment. In other words, it's like people buying a stock at a low price, hoping that it will appreciate in value. A lot of people are buying cryptocurrency with the hope not that they're going to use it to pay for their things, but rather that it's going to appreciate in value. In that space, it operates as a security. It is the observation of the Division of Banking and Securities and other state regulators that while that is still a lot of the space, you are seeing more people use cryptocurrency as a payment method, as a form of currency, or as a substitute for a government-backed currency. This is, if I had to pick a single most important slide of data, this would be it. This is the overall value of money transmission in Alaska to, from, and within Alaska in dollars. And as you can see in the chart, we've gone from 1.68 million in 2019 to a high of in 2021 of $7.1 billion, dipping down to $5.8 billion. A lot of the aberrant spike in 2021 was the $2 billion in cryptocurrency that traded hands that year. I think if you were to remove that, you would see a smoother climb up. But this industry, and this is a problematic comparison, and it's not entirely apples to apples, but I'm going to use it anyway to give you an idea of the magnitude of this. If you take that $5.8 billion that changed hands in money transmission, that is in the same neighborhood of the assets of our five state chartered financial institutions. So to get $5.8 billion, to state the obvious, in Alaska is an awful, awful lot of money. One other point that I'd like to state here, too, I firmly believe that access to mobile money transmission services anywhere you've got cellular data is potentially revolutionary in rural Alaska. You don't have to have a brick and mortar bank in your community in order to have access to these payment systems. And I believe that is very important for rural Alaskans, or potentially will become very important for rural Alaskans. Looking at money transmission volume compared to VC, at its high, it was $1.9 billion a year in 2021. Last year, it was $600 million. So about 18% in 2022 was 18% in 2022 was cryptocurrency. The remaining 82% was real money, U.S. dollars.
Do we have any idea of the breakdown of what sort of virtual currencies those were comprising those, or?
Thank you for the question, Chair. I do not have that information, nor do I think that information is provided to us by the industry. All of this information is self-reported to us by the industry.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, to the Chair, Mr. Schmidt. I'm going to ask you on slide 8 to kind of repeat again if you look at the bottom, a certain portion is money transmission, payment instrument, stored value by virtual currency, terminology with which I'm not entirely familiar, but I think I heard you say 80%+ is actually cash or money transmission. So if you're able to kind of give me a brief definition of each of those items and what portion of the total they represent.
Okay. So through the chair, and could you hear me okay with the mic placement? All right. So money transmission would be, for example, peer-to-peer, and that's the buying of the dresser off of Facebook Marketplace. Payment instruments, that's traveler's checks.
Okay.
I'd like to point out I'm old enough to remember those and to have bought some of those. stored value, that's the gift cards. Okay. The Applebee's gift cards that you buy at the grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And then virtual currency is cryptocurrency.
Thank you.
Representative Fields.
Sorry if I missed this through the chair. Who are the two biggest transmitters over a billion anyway?
I have been asked to not divulge them by name. I would tell you that they are all names with which you are readily familiar.
Okay.
I would also state that there is a piece of this legislation that allows certain disclosure publicly of information like that. So I would also say that those folks would consider their standing within Alaska to be something they would rather not have shared. So I apologize for that.
Okay.
So.
Sorry, what was the question we can't get answered?
Who are the biggest transmitters by, I guess, gross volume of money transmission?
Oh, just money transmission. Okay.
For example, was it X company or Y company or which?
I was just curious. Thanks.
Through the chair, I'd love to tell you, but I've been told I can't, and I apologize for that. All right. We can't talk about cryptocurrency without discussing its tumultuous year in 2022. There were three main crypto bankruptcies in 2022. The first were Voyager Digital and Celsius Network. 2,400 Alaska accounts valued at almost $20 million were frozen in those two bankruptcies. It is unclear if, when, or how much impact Alaskans might get back as these bankruptcies progress. The impact of the crypto bankruptcies on Alaskans make these bankruptcies an exceptionally large consumer loss, yet DBS received zero complaints. We often find that victims of financial harm often suffer in silence, but that silence does not mean Alaskans are not impacted. I think that it's also fair to state that having been able to look at the raw data, there were certainly people involved in these bankruptcies who were speculating with money that they probably could afford to lose. I would also venture to say that among this population, there were people impacted who were seriously financially impacted and harmed in these bankruptcies.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I appreciate your gentleness, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schmidt, in trying to understand, you said the two different reasons or two different ways people use virtual currencies is one as a medium of exchange, as its intended use, but also as an investment. And my understanding is that investment, it's almost like currency rate rate speculation. It's like you might buy a Bitcoin at X amount of money, and 2 days later, 2 months later, it's worth Y amount, and you sell it or transfer it. Is that kind of a good way to understand what you mean by the investment aspect of cryptocurrency?
Through the chair, yes. You may have heard the phrase Forex, foreign exchange,
yeah.
Forex. And, for example, it might be, for example, buying Mexican pesos or European Union euros and buying those not because you're going to take a trip to Mexico or you're going to take a trip to Paris, but rather that those currencies change in value and you might be able to sell it for more than you bought it and thereby make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
The concept is the same with cryptocurrency and speculating on cryptocurrency. The key difference is the phenomenally greater volatility of cryptocurrencies compared to many nations' currencies.
Thank you.
The largest cryptocurrency bankruptcy was the FTX trading bankruptcy, which suffered a spectacular collapse late last year. DBS is closely monitoring these and the other main crypto bankruptcies. We've spent hundreds, if not thousands, of staff hours watching these bankruptcies, both to ensure that to the greatest extent possible, Alaskans recover funds to which they are owed, but also to look forward so that any successor that comes out of these bankruptcies, frankly, does a better job of administering itself than those that went into bankruptcy. Regarding FTX, we have yet to get reliable data on the Alaska impact of this bankruptcy. What we do know is that FTX was bigger than Voyager and Celsius put together. Therefore, we expect that the Alaska impact of this bankruptcy was probably greater than the combined impact of the Voyager and Celsius bankruptcies. This bill does contain a fiscal note. I'd like to highlight some of the division's accomplishments in this regard. In 2012, we had a budget of we had receipts of $12.4 million against a budget of $3.5 million. In 2022, we had receipts of $22 million and against a budget of $4.3 million. The division will require additional staff and support costs to respond to the growth in the money service activities, the complexity of new business models, the use of third-party partnerships. These positions will allow the division to implement the new law, incorporate changes in the operation of NMLS, develop proficiency in the examination of electronic systems, and assessment of cybersecurity measures. We do expect that the revenue generated with this bill will more than cover the fiscal impact of this measure. Why do we need to change the act? So the current law has not kept up with the explosive growth and innovation. Quite frankly, the existing law was passed in 2007. It took effect in 2008, and it was written in the early 2000s. Cryptocurrency did not exist when our current law was written. Mobile payment systems such as PayPal were in their absolute infancy. PayPal was just starting out around the time that this law was being written, but these services, the Venmos and the Cash Apps, have exploded, and the law predates the explosion of this industry. This law will greatly reduce wasted staff time, increase automation, harmonize Alaska laws, and encourage business and reduce regulatory burden. Moving on to the final slide. What does this bill do? My chief of examinations, Tracy Reno, is going to be reading the sectional here momentarily, but I'd like to dive into the specifics and the meat of this law and what does it do. When you go through this law, you will see that a great deal of the 50 pages here involves licensing, examinations, and changing control. And what this bill intends to do is to harmonize Alaska's law with other states and to allow Alaska to work with other regulators on the licensing and examination of these entities. It allows us to use the NMLS system, the centralized registry, for registering financial service businesses. It'll maximizes our ability to utilize this system. Processes about 130 to 140,000 licenses a year. And think about that number for a minute. It's a massive number of licenses that we are able to process. Most of those are for investment advisors. The only way that we are able to do that kind of volume is through a highly standardized and automated system. If each one of these were a high touch system that required lots of individual attention, there's no way we would be able to handle all of these license applications. The money transmission applications are some of the very largest and most complicated. They would fill a 3-inch, 3-ring binder. So the provisions regarding to licensing examinations and change in control are all intended to allow us to rely on automated systems, to harmonize with other states, and to work with other states on this system. There is a significant section of the bill that's related specifically to crypto. These provisions include things such as disclosures that must be made when you're exchanging crypto. There is one key provision, and when I tell you what that key provision is, if you're not like, that sounds kind of like common sense, what do you mean? Well, believe me, it's important. And that is, there is a provision in this bill that specifically says if you are a crypto custodian, if you are holding virtual currency for someone else, that virtual currency belongs to that someone else and not to you. And you cannot pledge that virtual currency as an asset to your creditors. What we have seen in all of the cryptocurrency bankruptcies, in the Voyager, in the Celsius, and in the FTX bankruptcy, the customer account contracts all said, your crypto really belongs to us, and we, FTX, we, Voyager, we, Celsius, can pledge your crypto as an asset to our creditors. And so now what we are seeing in these bankruptcies is the creditors of these companies are saying, that crypto is our collateral, give it to us. The account holders are saying, wait, that's mine. This bill clarifies that with cryptocurrency, you cannot pledge someone else's crypto as as collateral for your own creditors. That phrase alone could have saved Alaskans on the order of $40 million if it had been adopted a year ago. Background checks. If I would encourage members of the committee, if you remember or you have a moment of spare time, to Google Tycoon Trading Alaska. It's the it's the Alaska Bernie Madoff. It's a fraud that we have uncovered. It's starting in September of last year. It involves about 180 Alaskans, tens of millions of dollars. Again, pure Bernie Madoff, friends of friends, and they all lost. And the guy promised unbelievable returns. He falsified all of his results, and he was robbing Peter to pay Paul. There are interviews from my investigators who spent a great deal of time on that investigation, doing great work, protecting Alaskans, coordinating with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and other law enforcement authorities. One of the other things that they have to do is they have to spend about 400 hours a year manually doing background checks. And the reason they have to do that is because our current law does not, the FBI will not allow automated background checks with our current law. I would like to free up these two investigators to do the important work, the much more important work, and allow the background checks to be automated. So that is one example of the automation that we are seeking to achieve with this law. There is a lot of language in this law regarding delegates. It is common in the money service, money transmission industry, that you will have a licensee in one state and they will hire what they call a delegate in another state. A recent example of a delegate situation that went poorly was a money transmitter from the lower 48 that had a delegate that operated a money transmission business out of the kitchen of their restaurant. There was poor internal controls, poor compliance with Bank Secrecy Act. It was a complete hot mess. They wound up shutting down, but there was a great deal of ambiguity about what delegates had to do. This law strengthens, if you have a delegate relationship, it strengthens that this is, you must have a written agreement with your delegate. This is what must be in this written agreement. These are the duties of your delegate. So a great deal of language in there regarding the responsibilities of delegate relationships that is not in the current law, and which has caused has been problematic for the division in the past. There is a whole lot of language in this bill regarding permissible investments. Going back to the Western Union example, if you've got thousands and thousands of people bringing you their $20 to send to their brother, you got a lot of money that you're responsible for sending. It has always been the case in the money transmission business that you had to have highly liquid, highly stable investments sufficient to meet your obligations. All those $20 that you were responsible for sending, you had to have assets to cover those. There is a lot of language in here that was carefully negotiated between industry and regulators regarding what permissible investments are allowed. Fees. This is an industry of whales and herring. Again, we got 168 money transmitters. The top two are over $1 billion, two from and within Alaska. The top eight are all over 100 million within Alaska. And then it gets a lot smaller from there, going down to a few million dollars. We charge the same fee to all of them, and it really makes no sense. And that's written into statute. This statute would allow us to put our fees into regulation so that we don't have to come back to the legislature every 15 years when our fees are horribly outdated. It would allow us to adopt a sliding fee scale, and it's a small fraction of a percent of, okay, this is how much business you do in Alaska, this is the tier you're in, this is the fee, and if you're lower down, it's a lesser fee. That would be highly advantageous to the domestic Alaska-based money transmitters, because again, they're paying the same $3,000, $2,000, a couple thousand bucks. They're paying the same couple thousand bucks as PayPal is. Lastly, what I would like to discuss before we move on to the sectional, or unless you have any other questions, this is a model law. This is a model law. It was drafted by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, of which my division is a member, with the participation of industry. It has been adopted in six states and is pending adoption in numerous other states. The states where it has been adopted in whole or in part are Arizona, Connecticut, Georgia, South Dakota, Utah, and West Virginia.
Representative Fields. And I can go after Representative Sadler if he was in the queue.
Okay. I was going to hold my question until you finish this up, but so please don't.
Okay. Well, on that point, I was just curious, and maybe could get back to us. What is the difference, if any, between the model bills as passed in these different states, or are they verbatim the same where they've been passed so far?
Through the chair, for one, I'm sure they're not verbatim the same. You know, for example, there are different drafting standards. In Alaska, we put our definitions at the back. Some states put their definitions at the front. It has been adopted almost completely with very little changes in Arizona, whereas Connecticut is adopting pieces at a time as they go. I cannot address in any greater detail other than that. I will say that both the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, industry, as well as on behalf of the Division of Banking and Securities, in order to function as a model law, it needs to be as standardized with as few changes as possible. A very similar bill was introduced last legislative session. There were some changes that came, some small changes that came about as a result of that. Those are incorporated in the draft that we have now. But this is very, very close to the uniform law.
Representative Sadler, you may want to ask your question now. I don't know that we will make it through the sectional because we're going to switch to 85 at 4 sharp.
Appreciate it. Oh, boy, goodness. Well, first, just to clarify through the chairman, Mr. Schmidt, this is about transactions within Alaska, from Alaska to the outside, and Alaskans who might be, well, so the entire universe of financial transactions in Alaska might take. It's not just within Alaska.
Through the chair, it involves transactions to, from, and within Alaska.
Very good. Okay. Briefly, follow up on slide 12, you talk about your receipts and your budget, et cetera. What is the source of your receipts? And is that inspection fees?
For example, we regulate, we issue, last year we issued, through the chair, in 2022, we issued, as I recall, 123,000 licenses to investment advisors. That was at $75 a pop. There are the licensing fees for the 168 money transmitters, which are a couple thousand dollars a pop. There are, for example, we regulate the mortgage industry. And there are the mortgage loan originators, i.e. the actual individuals. They pay a licensing fee. There are assessments on the banks. We represent the five state chartered depository financial institutions. That's four banks, one credit union, North Rim, Denali, McKinley, First Bank, and then Credit Union One. We represent payday lenders, and they pay a fee as well. I hope that gives you an idea of the universe from where our revenue comes.
Okay.
I would point out, we like to feel that we regulate Wall Street on behalf of Alaska, and between Wall Street and other financial institutions, that is where our revenue comes.
Okay.
Okay. The states in which it has been introduced, including Alaska right now with this introduction, Georgia, Hawaii, Indiana, Iowa, Massachusetts, Minnesota, you get the idea. This is a very diverse set of, you know, across the political spectrum, rural, urban, coastal states, Midwestern states. Planning for 2023 later this year, it's planned to be introduced in 11 states. Planning for next year, that's 10 states. That's well over half the country. It's about three quarters of the states have either adopted it, it's been introduced now, it'll be introduced later this year or next year. Unless you have any further questions, I would defer to my colleague to start the sectional analysis unless the needs of the committee are otherwise.
It may make, I don't believe that we'll make it through the sectional analysis in 5 minutes because it's pretty extensive. So it may make sense to just cut here and continue this at a later meeting if that is all right with you guys.
That is fine.
Okay, so with that, we'll set aside HB 86 and we will take up HB 85. Another billet request to the governor. We got Sylvan Robb, director of the Alaska Corporation's Business and Professional Licensing, to present this bill. Can you put your name on the record and begin your presentation? Thank you.
Is the right bill?
Yeah.
So we got so a good day.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here to talk about something that the division is very excited about. For the record, I'm Sylvan Robb. I'm the director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing at the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. And Mr. Chair, is your preference for the presentation first and then the sectional, or?
Yeah, let's do that and we'll hold questions till the very end. Thank you.
Thank you. This is much less complicated than. So moving on to slide two, universal temporary licensure is almost exactly what it sounds like. So this bill would allow the department to issue temporary licenses to qualified professionals who have a license that required substantially similar requirements from another U.S. or Canadian jurisdiction. So this will allow people to get to work in Alaska faster. There are two other ways to qualify for a temporary license under this legislation besides having a license in another jurisdiction. If a person can demonstrate that they substantially have met Alaska's licensing requirements, but they are coming from another jurisdiction that doesn't license the profession in question, they can obtain one of these temporary licenses. So, for example, massage therapists are not licensed in all 50 states, only 45. Naturopaths are licensed in about 20 states. And then the final route that a person can use to meet these requirements is if they have obtained the requirements in Alaska for that license, either through military service, education, or training. Moving on to slide three. So how does a person get a universal temporary license? This is not like driving, where you just have a license from another state and you come up to Alaska and just start driving around. Individuals coming from another jurisdiction will still have to submit an application to the department and provide documentation that they have a license in good standing in another jurisdiction or demonstrate that they qualify through one of those two other pathways that I mentioned. If there's a criminal history background check that is required for the Alaska license in the profession in question, that will be required, and then they'll have to pay the fee related to the temporary license. So you might be wondering how we can know that professionals working under these temporary licenses are safe to practice in Alaska. And the way we'll know that is that you cannot get one of these temporary licenses if the jurisdiction that you're coming from does not have substantially similar requirements to obtain that license. So, you know, for example, if another state said, we don't really need you to have gone to medical school to be a doctor. No state does that. But if they did, then you would not qualify to get a temporary license here in Alaska. Additionally, the individual cannot have any disciplinary action or be in the middle of a disciplinary action in that other jurisdiction. and you cannot have committed an act that would prevent you from getting a license in Alaska because of that act within the last 10 years. So how does university temporary licensure work here on slide 4? So these licenses would be valid for 180 days. There is an option for a one-time extension of an additional 180 days at the department's discretion. This would occur under circumstances where a temporary licensee can show that they're working toward obtaining a permanent licensure, but they were unable to meet the requirements during that first 180-day period. So, for example, if maybe a course they needed to take was not offered or they had some extenuating life circumstances. Holders of these temporary licenses must follow all of Alaska's statutes and regulations related to their profession. So the scope of practice is not where you had that initial license that allows you to qualify for this, but you need to follow all of the statutes and regulations related to the profession here in Alaska. And of course, you need to follow all of our other statutes and regulations as well. The department can revoke one of these licenses if we find out that it was obtained through deceit, fraud, or intentional misrepresentation. And so one thing I do want to call out is that if we wanted to be more specific, we might call this nearly universal temporary licensure. So there are three professions that are not covered by this of the 43 that are licensed by the division, and those are ones that have Alaska-specific knowledge that's required. And so that would be marine pilots, because obviously, you know, being familiar with waters in Louisiana doesn't do us any good or make you safe to operate here. Likewise, the big game guides and related occupations. Again, we want people to be familiar with our fauna, our terrain, our weather, our fish and game statutes and regulations. And then the final one are the professions that are covered by the Board of Registration for engineers, architects, and land surveyors. And again, thinking about knowledge that's needed to safely build in Alaska, you need to be familiar with Arctic and subarctic building, thinking about permafrost, other really regional knowledge that would be required. So moving on to slide 5, now that we know what universal temporary licensure is and how it works, why do we need this? Alaska is experiencing a workforce shortage in several fields, and it's time to streamline the process to allow professionals to quickly get to work in Alaska. So it's no secret that processing times are lengthening for many of the division's programs, despite the hard work of staff and our board members. This is due in part to the fact that we've had a 64% increase in professional licenses issued since 10 years ago. So it's been a very substantial increase. And then that's been compounded by staffing shortages and a great deal of staff turnover within the division. I am very happy to report that we are seeing substantial improvement in our staffing situation in the division. During the worst of the pandemic in the professional licensing team, we had an over 35% vacancy rate. By the end of the last fiscal year, we were down to 20%, and that has continued to decline. So today we have a 13% vacancy rate. So we're really making strides getting folks hired and trained. Additionally, universal temporary licensure is a concept that's being adopted in many states. So 18 states already have adopted this concept, although it looks slightly different in all of them. So as the division is trying to improve processing times, we are looking to have all the tools in the toolbox, and we are seeing universal temporary licensure is one more way for us to get people licensed and to work in Alaska as quickly as possible. Part of how this would work is that for professionals looking for permanent licensure in Alaska, the department will issue a temporary license automatically at the point the applicant meets the qualifications for the temporary license on their way to that permanent license. And so that really helps the division, because instead of someone who, you know, wants to get the temporary license to get to work right away, but also wants a permanent license, instead of getting two applications from that individual, we'll just get one application where they can indicate that they're interested in having temporary and permanent. Additionally, it has the opportunity to save us a fair amount of work because we have a number of people who are only interested in a temporary license for whatever reason. They're coming to Alaska for a shorter period of time to fill a vacancy, and they're not looking for a permanent license. Right now, we get that license application, look through it, and say, you have enough, you know, you could get a temporary license, and then we take the time to figure out what they're missing for that permanent license, communicate that to them, and this will prevent us from spending that time for individuals who are not interested in obtaining that permanent license. You may be wondering why this is necessary, because the boards do have the ability to issue temporary licenses. Some of our boards have taken advantage of that opportunity, but others have not. And so this gives us the option for all of those professions to obtain this temporary license. Additionally, we have a few boards where we have several different kinds of temporary licensure. And so I think this will make it easier for applicants who are outside and maybe looking at some of those opportunities where there are, you know, two or three different kinds of temporary licenses to not have to figure out which one is most appropriate for their situation. And then the standardization of this temporary licensure option will assist staff in knowing what they're looking for in order to issue a temporary license. Moving on to slide six, looking at, you know, what evidence do we have the universal temporary licensure will help with our processing times? So currently, the Alaska State Medical Board, as well as the Board of Nursing, have led the way in making temporary permits part of the permanent licensure process. And although the temporary licensure does require some additional tracking and communication beyond what was previously needed for the permanent license, it eliminated the need for professionals to submit applications, as I just mentioned. So it reduces the number of applications we're handling. Regulation changes made by these boards allowed physicians, physician assistants, registered nurses, and practical nurses to work in Alaska while staff within the division, those licensing examiners, are continuing to go through and collect their additional documentation needed to get that permanent licensure. Many times it can be a little slow for us to obtain necessary documents for someone to get a permanent license because they come from a third party. So we need primary source verification for people's education and for proof of employment in many cases. And so obtaining those can take some time because it's not on the applicant to get those sent to us. So we now also know that there are several compact bills that are before the legislature this session. And we just wanted to address a little bit the difference between universal temporary licensure and compacts. At this point, like I said, we're really looking for all the tools we can have. So we're looking at universal temporary licensure, some of these compacts, but we're also looking internally at everything we can do to improve processing time. And so we're working with staff. CBPL is really kind of a volume business with 300,000 licensees, business licenses, corporations registered. And so anywhere we can find that shaves even, you know, 5 minutes off a transaction actually makes a big difference for us. One of the things that we do want to address is that I know nursing shortage is something that many people have been hearing about and are aware of. And currently the division is, it takes us some time before we are able to pick up a nursing application and look at those. And so the nurse licensure compact is one of the options that we're looking at because that will reduce the number of applications that the division has to process. So here on slide eight, you can see, as I mentioned earlier, there are 18 other states that have adopted universal temporary licensure in some form. And this map by the Council of State Governments shows you which states have universal temporary licensure as of May of last year. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know that was kind of fast, but I also know we have a clock running, so.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Robb, I guess this kind of begs the question, why don't we just have one office for occupational licensing that does all? Why do we have 70, you know, different boards and boards for occupational licensing? Maybe why not just have one? I'm not really seeing, frankly, how this is going to save any time. If those seeking to practice their profession in Alaska and seek to obtain a professional license but have to maintain, have to can be operating consistently and meet all the qualifications, not quite sure where the advantage is.
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, just to kind of start at the beginning. So we license 43 different professional areas. And it's 125 different professions. So just to sort of split that out for you, like a professional area would be dental, and then we license dentists and dental hygienists. And so some of the boards have as many as 10 different professions that are licensed by that particular board. Of those 43 different professional areas, 21 of those are have a licensing board. And the benefit of having the different licensing boards is that we have the expertise of people within that profession to help set the regulations and the scope of practice for that profession. Mm-hmm. Obviously, people within the division, we don't have people who have expertise. We can't afford to hire a doctor and a nurse and a dentist and a chiropractor within the division to give us that expertise. And so that's what we get from having those boards. Additionally, they set the regulations. They also are the ones who review applications for permanent licensure for some of the boards. They review every single applicant before that person is issued a license to practice in the state of Alaska. They also look at when there are disciplinary issues to determine if a violation has occurred. And so that's the benefit that we get from having those boards. So where this does help us is that this is allowing the division to issue this temporary license. So we're not dependent on waiting for when there's going to be a board meeting to review some of those.
To the chair, follow up. I'm still not quite sure the reason why we have those professional boards is because they give due diligence and do the work they need to do. If we're able to process licenses and still protect public safety and health, et cetera, why will we still need to have those, except to set regs? I'm still not. If we're going to be hurrying up, I don't see where the expedition is going to come, how much more faster it's going to come. And if we're able to issue temporary licenses in safety and confidence, why have a distinction between temporary and permanent? Let's just make an endorsement on any license. Do you want this to be for 180 days or in perpetuity or a year by year?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, I think what you're suggesting is really sort of license reciprocity to say, if you have a license anywhere, that's good in Alaska. And this, again, in order to obtain a temporary license, the division will be checking to make sure that the jurisdiction where you currently hold a license has substantially similar requirements. And so
it's going to be a big job, isn't it?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we do have a couple positions in the fiscal note to assist us with that. While in theory there are a very large number of jurisdictions and professions where we would need to check to make sure the requirements are substantially similar, I think all of us who have talked to many Alaskans know that there's an awful lot of people who come from a smaller subset of states. And so I think that once we have checked, a handful of states, that will cover a majority of the temporary licensees that we need to check. But the benefit comes in that we're not getting two applications from someone. So if you were coming from another state and you wanted a temporary license because you're anxious to get to work, excited to be here, and you want a permanent license because you're planning to stay, you love Alaska, we would get two applications from you. And so we would have to process all the way through the temporary licensure application, issue you that license, and then start again as though we'd never met you on that permanent license application. And so this way we can say, hey, we're 5 of the 10 steps through this process. And so now for you to get a permanent license, we only have to do those remaining steps. And so it will reduce the workload for the division. We're certainly not proposing this because it's going to make more work for us. We're hoping that this will really speed getting people to work.
Representative Fields, and then I do apologize, but we will have to adjourn and continue your sectional analysis at a later meeting.
Thanks to the chair. Ms. Robb, could you just go back to the slide, UTL versus compacts, please? Thank you. I think I like the slide in the fourth bullet down, reduces barriers for in-state practitioners intending to practice in other states. UTL does not do that. So I kind of like this bill because we're encouraging people to come here, but we're not encouraging them to leave. The National Bureau of Economic Research published a paper, Labor Supply Effects of Occupational Regulation, Evidence from the Nurse License Compact. And I'll actually distribute this to committee members. It's a really interesting and very robust study that found that states that implemented the Nurse License Compact found no positive effect in terms of labor supply. And I think intuitively one might guess because people come in, but they also leave. And I like the UTL model of bringing people in, but not encouraging them to leave. So thank you for bringing this forward.
And with that, we will adjourn. The time is 4:16 p.m.